is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And I'd like to welcome everybody to our kind of irregular, but on a regularly irregular free-for-all show where it's just Eagle One and myself. And this is an opportunity, especially for those usual suspects and the regulars who perhaps in the course of the last few months since our last open phones, open ideas point, we haven't quite discussed a topic that you really wanted us to, or for just a couple of issues you wanted to roll that way to see if Eagle One and I had a take that you might find interesting. This is a chance for you. If you'd like, you can call in directly. We're going to live on the edge and really not even screen our calls for a change. If you want to call in and ask our question directly, you can reach us at 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. If you suffer from a significant case of stage fright and you would just like to come in and ask us the questions on the chat room. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you can find the usual suspects. We'll be monitoring that in the course of the show in order to see if you got some questions you'd rather ask there, though we do like the photographs. We do like the phone calls. So, Eagle One, no photographs on the radio show, but besides that, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you? Can you hear me? I can't tell whether my phone is muted or not.
No, we hear your comforting dulcet tones just fine.
Hey, we should tell the listeners that we're the walking wounded today. For some reason, my Skype won't ring into Blog Talk Radio, and so I'm on a cell phone, and you're suffering from nostalgia, neuritis, and some other painful infliction. So yeah, if the show seems a little more bizarre than usual, folks, it's just because it's more bizarre than usual.
Yeah, I know. Without going into too much detail, if I seem a little more off than usual, maybe you won't notice. I've got some medical issues going on that's a little distracting, but that's the great thing about radio. You can't see me crying. Anyway, I wanted to kick off. Obviously, it's been the big surprise over the weekend, and there's a couple of different schools that have come out, and I can see both sides of the issue, but after they're both on the table, one quickly disappears and the other one's rather solid. And that's Bergdahl's bargain for his family, who's been a prisoner of the Taliban for quite a while. I guess the executive summary is he walked off base, got snagged, and we traded five of the Haqqani Network's top players to get him back. You know, I'm real happy for his family. I'm real happy for him. But that's the initial flush. It's one of those emotions versus reality. And yeah, I think what this has done is it really has increased the price on the top of everybody's head because we had the reputation of we're not going to negotiate with you, but we will kill you. Now it's like, yeah, if we're holding somebody that's really important to you, why don't you see if you can steal one of our guys? And I don't know that with some of the other things that are going on, Eagle One, whether that's really the right message we want to put out here, because the long war, regardless of what we do in did in Iraq and whatever we're in the process of doing in Afghanistan, you know, the war is not over when one side says it's over. The war is over when both sides say it's over. And I don't think the other side of the equation thinks the war is over, and we continue to put out a message of weakness, a message of submission, and you know, I think we're the first geniuses to say that weakness invites aggression. So I'm happy for Bergdahl's family, but for our nation and for everybody else, that is serving. I have to say I'm not too pleased with how we went about this. What's your shot there, Eagle One?
Yeah, we my wife and I had a discussion about this earlier today, and it came down kind of the way you are. I mean, if a lot of it depends on the circumstances under which he left his base, how he was captured, and what his position has been since he's been gone. That's part one. Part two is, do we want to get in the business of negotiating with terrorists? Or is it possible? I mean, Secretary of Defense Hagel said there were some extenuating circumstances in this case, which they also used, the White House also used as a reason for violation of the law, which said they're not supposed to do this without consulting Congress. So, you know, I'm kind of walking down the middle of this one where I'm glad to get him back, I guess, but I really don't like the idea of, as you say, putting a price on every other serviceman's head that, you know, that we're willing to negotiate to get people back by releasing people that don't necessarily like us, although we have all kinds of reassurances from the country to whom they're being sent that they'll keep an eye on them.
It takes a while to get through some of the partisan flacking about this, but you brought up something that concerns me in a larger context, is even when you strip away a lot of the partisan bickering and usual movements, there's been a lot of extra constitutional activity that's been going on by this administration, a lot of blatant violation of the law. I'm not an attorney, but there are members of Congress on both sides of the House that, as we've seen in the past, when these type of notifications need to take place, they can keep a secret. There are some that, you know, you wouldn't trust your car keys, but there are some serious individuals up there that do get the check in the block for consulting Congress. I prefer to think about the info ops campaign and how this message goes on, but I guess there are some larger, more important issues inside our lifelines about this violation of law. What recourse do the other branches of government have for something like this? Because this is not the first case that a law that was passed by a co-equal branch of the government has been basically blown off with just a shrug of the shoulders. And having spent some time around a few military JAGs and a few operational plans and a few civilian legal advisors coming in with any plan you have, they tell you whether what you're doing is actually legal. So another question I have is, where in the course of this operation was the JAG coming along and going, sir, you're being given an illegal order. Is this the type of situation where that can come up? And what is a commander's responsibility, or for that matter, a senior JAG's responsibility to go, oh, we're going to do X. Well, if we're going to do X, then Y needs to take place. My understanding, Y is not taking place, so we're going to be executing a set of orders that's in violation of U.S. law. Is that a black-white thing, a gray area, or is that a question that our legal professionals just probably don't want to talk about?
Well, unlike you, I am an attorney, and but also like you, I'm not a JAG. My experience would tell me that the people who decided to do this somehow, except for telling the commander of the Guantanamo Bay facility to turn these guys loose, I don't know whether this took place in a military context, and I don't think that has really been made clear in the articles I've read, whether this was, you know, an order from the President of the United States to Admiral so-and-so to go do this, and Admiral so-and-so said, you know, you can't do that, sir, or if this is, you know, there's some other chain of command which this is following which does not have that same responsibility. But I also know there are situations where the President can give top cover to the chain of command, and it happens mostly, I think, in some kind of classified operations, that, you know, there's a presidential directive saying, this is on me, and I'm telling you to do this, and, you know, that can work. I think. I'm not sure. I don't think anybody's ever challenged that. This, as you said, though, this administration carefully, as on several occasions, carefully weighed the potential effects of engaging in outside the line activity, and I think their view is that the worst case is that somebody will sue them, and by the time that wends its way through the legal process, that these guys will be long gone, and the issue will be completely moot, and it may make great law somewhere down the path, but not while these guys are in office.
Yeah, I can definitely see that political calculus. I would just really like to see some military professionals go through a few vignettes of where they say no, because as officers, you don't take your oath to the President of the United States, to the executive branch. You don't make your oath to Congress or your judiciary. You make your oath to the Constitution. Now, that's a pretty darn vague area. And as you know, you ask an opinion of two attorneys, you get five answers. An illegal order is an illegal order, or are there different, shades of gray of illegal orders, and where do you draw that line? To quote the president on a different issue when he was a candidate for office, I guess that's a little bit above my pay grade. But I'd be interested to know where that pay grade is, because even as you say, and thank goodness we don't know all the details of this operation, nor should we, but I don't think anybody goes in to Northeast Afghanistan to do a partner exchange without using the U.S. military. CIA has some great capabilities, but I would be highly doubtful that this was strictly a CIA operation. Maybe it was, but then again, way beyond my pay grade.
Well, I mean, if we look at what we do know, he's not being released directly back to the people that these guys from Guantanamo are not being released directly back to the Taliban. They're being released to another country, which is a procedure that has been followed before, although not in connection with a prisoner swap. So I can see where they've wandered down this path. Somebody did some thinking about this, and it's the legality of a notify Congress, except, and apparently there's an exception in their rule, that except in when there's a need, which Secretary Hagel says there is, some kind of extraordinary circumstance, then that's your out. You didn't do anything illegal because it was certified from above that there was some special circumstance.
Yeah, that's the trapdoor situation, and I can appreciate that, and I doubt very much that the Republicans in Congress are going to raise too much of stink about this, because they have been the party that tends to defer to presidential freedom of action when it comes to foreign entanglement, so to speak. I think if the political hat was switched over, I think you might see a little more of a ruckus about this, but unfortunately, there's not a caucus on the Republican side of the House that really is going to make a stink about that, and if there's not that type of desire, then nothing's really going to happen. I guess we'll have to wait for somebody's memoir in 5 or 6 years to see how it worked out.
Well, we may see, depending on what the circumstances of this guy's departure from the base and ended up him getting captured or whatever happened to him, and I've seen a lot of speculation on why he was over the wire. There's going to be some questions down the road, but it's very hard. I would think if you're in opposition to this, to the party in power in the White House, that you are going to go to the American people and say you're against getting an American out of the hands of terrorists, no matter what it took. That's kind of a tough sell. So I think they'll maintain a low profile, but we'll see how it goes down the road.
Yeah, it's one of those we'll see what's going. I think the argument could be made amongst people who are associated with the national security arena, but I think for 97% of the population, all they have to do is say, well, somebody's family got their son, brother, cousin back, and that's all that matters.
We did it for the children. Speaking of doing it for the children, Boko Haram in Nigeria. Should we be messing around with that at all?
And again, this is that one brain versus the other. Well, first of all, they're not our girls. They're Nigeria's girls. Just like you can't make somebody love you, you can't make another nation care about their own citizens more than you do. You just can't do it. That part of northern Nigeria, how do you pronounce it, the Sahel, otherwise known as the transition area from the Sahara south, huge open area. I have no doubt in my mind that if we had freedom of action, we could go in and do what needs to be done. But we would be castigated and hated for it, because to do something like that, pretty good chance some of the girls are going to die. And then the usual suspects will come out of the woodwork, and I don't think the present administration has the appetite to be called those nasty names. If Good Luck Johnson doesn't want to rescue his own people, he's in the middle of an existential threat to his nation, and Boko Haram is just part of that. If he's not willing to do the hard things that need to be done when you're in a type of religious sectarian civil war like that in order to win, then, you know, he'll continue to empower and give victories to his opponents, and the bloodshed will continue. But I fully understand that the well-meaning people who, you know, hear about almost 300 girls kidnapped from their boarding school all because all they wanted to do was to learn. But, you know, my memory is good enough that I remember right after we got through the drive up the Kandahar Valley and liberated Kabul, and we just had a few forces on the ground, and all the women were lifting their burqas off, and everybody said, well, we can't just, you know, get rid of the Al-Qaeda camps and chase them into the mountains. We got to stay here and do what we didn't do after the Soviets were kicked out, to help the Afghan build their people and educate their women, and, you know, build a Disneyland park off in Gore Valley, whatever. You know, there's that instinct to want to do that, just like we did in Somalia. You know, well-meaning people want to do good things, but this is a world that doesn't work that way. And
in the context of Nigeria, where I was reading earlier that they spend about 1%, I think, of their gross national product on education. You know, I mean, it's a hugely corrupt country, and they don't spend much on the infrastructure. They don't spend much on the population. As a result, they have a large chunks of uneducated young people. You know, there's a bulge, just like in a lot of other countries. You know, and they're kind of leaving themselves open. Unless they start taking some of that oil money, and they have plenty of that, and spending it to improve the lives of their people, the people are going to get the message that, you know, they really don't care about us. They care about lining their own pockets and their lifestyle. But as far as those of us in the heat, and that seems to be I'm probably several years out of phase on the or guerrilla or indigenous rebel forces come from. But it seems to me that there's going to be an attraction to some people who are being told that these problems are because you know, of the corrupt government and the U.S. help and all that stuff, and they're just going to, you know, that's the kind of movement that you don't really want to get started in a country the size of Nigeria, with the population Nigeria has, which I think is a couple hundred million people, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, and I'm very hesitant on this also because of the, welcome to the first Clinton administration, late Bush 41 administration, you know, the CNN effect. Okay, you got 200 and some odd change girls in Nigeria. A map was put out recently of the whole Sahel area, southern Sahara, where we have mostly special forces and enablers deployed around there to help local forces. You know, where do you draw your line for your tragedy? Let's roll the clock back to Darfur. The genocide still taking place in Darfur. I remember when there was discussions of NATO doing something in Darfur. A friend of mine, a lieutenant colonel in the Italian army, who ironically grandfather fought in Ethiopia in World War II. You know, he went to Ethiopia back in the last decade to start doing some of the initial work where NATO was looking going in there, but NATO looked over at Big Daddy USA and said, well, you're going to be giving most of the forces, aren't you? And after we just sat there and blinked and looked at our toes for a little bit, that whole evaporated. So if the, you know, hashtag diplomacy of bring home our girls, if that's our trigger point to go and chase dragons around the southern edge of the Sahara, are we going to go join the French in Mali, Central Africa Republic? Are we going to go in at the tip of the bayonet and tell the democratically elected president of Uganda that he needs to let the hundreds of homosexuals that they've imprisoned out? Are we going to go into the border areas of Kenya? You know, where do you draw that line? I think we need to be very, very careful.
Yeah, that's always been my question about these humanitarian interventions, which many people the more liberal persuasion seem to be in favor of. They're not really, you know, they're willing to spend our blood and money to engage in humanitarian interventions without thinking about the possible consequences of some of those actions. I mean, as you note, that area of Nigeria is more is in a rough area. It's a rough neighborhood, an area that that the other people who live in neighboring countries, or some of the people who live in neighboring countries, would like to combine into a larger mass, and you know, have their, you know, they're already burning Christian churches and killing Christians and stuff like that. So it's just a really tough area, and this particular organization, it's one thing to kidnap the girls and all that, but then to announce on a YouTube video that you're going to sell them into slavery and then go ahead and do it with at least a few of the girls, that I can see why people get their trigger does get pulled on that, but the consequences of involvement. If we don't get involved, then everybody fears another Rwanda. If we do get involved, Lord knows where it leads. So it's a tough call.
Yeah, unlike Rwanda, which is, you know, the size of a couple of American counties strapped together, they killed hundreds of thousands of their neighbors there. You get a country like Nigeria. Over in the chat room, Maggie put in $168 million. I'm too lazy to fact check her. I'll trust Maggie, because if you don't, she'll hurt me. That's a whole different scale. If you can kill 800,000 people in sectarian violence in Rwanda, if you have the right trigger and the right desire, now admittedly they aren't as densely packed as they are, then, you know, the Nigeria bloodbath is just almost unimaginable. But here's the thing for the young kiddies, and we have to be careful what we establish as well, is Sub-Saharan Africa, you outlined very well, extremely corrupt except for a few small islands. For instance, Botswana, right north of South Africa, it's probably the best governed country in Southern Africa. If such a huge percentage of their population did not have AIDS, their economy would really do well. There's some great graphs out there of your average lifespan in Botswana. It climbed and climbed and climbed until HIV grabbed hold, and it's just plummeted. It all has to do with HIV, and that takes people out in their prime. South Africa, the ANC, each election they lose a little bit of their percentage of power. Zuma's corrupt. South Africa has some potential. And there are a few other ones like Mozambique that are trying. Angola's trying. So there are places in Africa we can help out, but when you combine the structural problems in that part of the world with the demographics that you have, here in about 15, 20 years, 168 million Nigerians become 275 million Nigerians. The economy is not growing enough to give those people. That's a decreasing standard of living, growing population in a non-unified country. The future looks a little spotty for that part of the world. So, before we start putting bases and engaging it, need to be very careful about how closely tied in do we want to be in that part of the world, because it's really not our fight.
Yeah, well, it's that. I guess that puts me in mind of the president's recent speech at West Point, where he kind of laid out a strategy. we're going to lead or something without getting hurt. I can't remember exactly what the words were.
Lead from behind?
well, no, he didn't say lead from behind for a change. I mean, he did say that we would act unilaterally if we had to protect our allies, which I thought was kind of a nice shot across the bow of China. But I have more questions about what that means in situations like Nigeria and some of those places where it's, we've got, there are human reasons to do humanitarian interventions, but, and I'll just, you kind of trail off from there. There's a big but at the end of all that. So, but did he update his previous discussion at West Point that you have harped on for a few years now?
Yeah, anybody that's gone over to my home blog, and I put some other stuff over at Breitbart when I used to write over there a couple years ago. But, the December 2009 West Point speech that, for all intents and purposes, announced our strategic withdrawal, timed withdrawal, retreat, however you want to refer to it. The latest West Point speech, though, I started to write about it, and to be blunt, because I can't be on internet radio, I just said to hell with it. I just don't have the emotion. People should watch the tape. Better than that, read it. It was a canned campaign speech. There was no enthusiasm, no excitement. The whole premise of it is just depressing. There's really nothing we can do about it. And like I like to tell people, there's no reason to get upset about it. This is what the American people voted for twice. And agree with it or disagree it, it just is. And unfortunately, what I think we're going to have happen here is we're creating the conditions and setting an environment that another president, whether it's a Hillary Clinton or a Rand Paul or my buddy Scott Walker or somebody else who will come out of the woodwork, is going to have to fix it. Because there's no fixing going on here. There's pushing to the right. There's slapping a Band-Aid. There's taking a couple of Tylenol. But there's no real fixing of problems. About the only place that our vacillation has played out pretty well, and I'll agree with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, the president's policy in Syria has been pretty good. I think you could boil down the president's Syria policy as let them kill each other, because that's really not our fight. My take has always been with Syria that if Turkey's not willing to put a division into the north, then why on God's green earth should we be willing to do anything? It's just not our fight. But about the president's West Point speech and what followed, the 9,800 people on the ground in a country that size, that's enough to run Bagram and to have a few support facilities in there, and that's about it. I just hope they have enough airlift to get those 9,800 out so we don't have to take extraordinary measures to get through Jalalabad so we have one person come through the Khyber Pass on the back of a horse, because that's just a stupid number.
Well, the foreign policy, to make sense, has to be consistent. And I guess he's been consistent in sort of a way that I would disagree with, but his lead from behind policy has been the way he approaches it. And every now and then he kind of makes threats to break out of that, the various red lines, the pivot to Asia. And I thought it was kind of funny Secretary of Defense Hagel was in Singapore and gave a speech, a presentation, along with the Japanese Prime Minister Abe, who, they were both pinging on China for their China's reckless disregard of international boundaries in the South China Sea. And I thought that was a lot stronger than what the president said. So I don't know if he's made Hagel his point man for strong international activity, or if Hagel's off on his own and shows some of the strength that some people said he had all along, and it's called China on their, you know, that, are they just a bully, and he's calling their bully bluff, or is this part of a strategy out of the administration?
Well, you know, if we're really going to be focusing our attentions elsewhere, it's not sub-Saharan Africa. It's the Western Pacific. Now, you look at that arc of economic interest that we have that goes from the tip of Japan all the way down to Australia, the Straits of Malacca. You know, though I think we forget about it on a regular basis, we're a mercantile republic. Both directly and indirectly, we thrive on good, stable, global trade. And, you know, what China does on mainland Asia to their own people is really none of our business. But when you look around with our neighbors, especially Japan, South Korea, I really like the rapprochement, however you pronounce that in French. Claude, help me out. With Vietnam, I think that's in good shape. I think we could, and I think we are in the background, you know, continuing to whisper in Taiwan's ear, we're still your buddy, we just can't tell anybody. They're kind of our secret lover down the street. You know, that's a good strategy, and part of that is to make sure that China knows that, you know, be a bully if you want to, but be careful. Be careful what you're doing. I know we had an incident where China rammed a Vietnamese vessel. The Vietnamese have hated China for millennia. The Japanese and the Chinese have never liked anybody, each other. The Koreans have never liked them. The Filipinos used to not care until recently. Nobody really likes China that I'm aware of, except for maybe Burma, Myanmar, whatever you want to call it. And I think that's to our advantage. And if you have Vietnam that we could support, they know that Japan has a support, Korea to its support, then maybe that will stop China from doing something a little stupid, getting in the way of the sea lines of communications on the Western Pacific. I think the day of us considering the Pacific our lake is long gone, but the first island chain east still pretty much is, and I think a strong Japan is part of that. Some people are not comfortable with Abe and some of the changes he's making about making Japan a little more militaristic. That, it doesn't bother me at all. I am not worried about a rearmed Japan. I'm just not. It's a hugely different country than it was in the mid 20th century. We should give them the benefit of the doubt. They're quasi-Western in many regards, but demographically and philosophically, they're not an expansionist power. But boy, if they spent 3 to 4% of their GDP on the military, that would be a way to keep Japan, keep China inside the first island chain, and finding other ways to get the resources they need.
Yeah, Japan has recently offered gunboats to both Vietnam and the Philippines to assist them in their national security interests. And then I saw something the other day that apparently the Australians were looking at Japanese submarines as a possible. I can't remember Japan if they actually had a deal or they were just looking, but that I'm not as familiar with Japanese submarines as I should be, but I gather they're pretty competent.
They're very, very good. Yeah, the Japanese diesel submarines, for those that have played with them, the Australians could do a lot worse than
and have done worse with their current boats.
Yeah, speaking of Australia, let's talk about what the Australians have done interesting. And I kind of brought it up obliquely when we were talking about Africa. But, you know, one of the great things of this century is there are parts of the world that have stable to gently declining populations, Japan, Western Europe, Australia, Singapore, other places, that as the nasty parts of the world have growing populations and shrinking per capita GDP, you know, the push for to immigrate, that natural human instinct for those people, you saw it recently with another rush of the gates at one of Spain's little outposts in northern Africa again, and they've just cleaned up some places around Cannes with migrants trying to get into the UK. I think that's going to be a growing story. Australia just really ratcheted up their immigration laws, where if they intercept you trying to immigrate illegally by sea, not only are they going to send you home, you will never have a chance to ever immigrate to Australia. They'll put your name and your biometrics in the system, and they don't care what you do 10, 20 years from now, you'll never get in there. So they really have ratcheted down in the lucky country, which is smart for them, because when you reach a certain tipping point, you can lose the character of your country if you just let yourself get flooded by immigrants from cultures that are completely opposite from where yours is. There's one thing to have a few percentage of your population, but when you get too much, then the whole nature of your country changes and you lose your countries. And we're already seeing that in a few places in Europe. I think the Europeans are going to have more of a huge problem with that, simply because of ease of access. And a lot of them will probably go, if they're smart, in the direction of Japan, which pretty much lets nobody in except for a few Koreans. And I also read recently that even Korea, in the rural areas, a lot of the farmers are marrying wives from Vietnam, for instance, simply because the South Korean women, like their Japanese counterparts, they want to be urban. They don't want to live out there in the countryside. So I think that the pressures of immigration and the reaction to it is going to be an interesting indirect national security story for the next few decades, as does that difference in demographics between the first world steady or declining population and the poorer parts of the world, the expanding populations and mass density kind of reaches a tipping point. Which direction it goes to, I don't know.
Well, have you been following the recent elections in Europe and EU and Germany and France?
Oh, yeah.
They always call them right wing. But let's say the more conservative elements of those political structures seem to be gaining speed. What does that hold for Europe's future? Even the Germans, apparently the more to the right than the Christian Democrats groups have popped up. Let me throw one more thing in there. And apparently the Russians have been actively involved in creating, was it Hungary, in creating parties that trot around in Nazi-like uniforms. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on out there that is really interesting if you start taking a look at it.
Yeah, it's just another way to try to destabilize Western Europe. But I think you brought up a good point. I think the description of right wing is kind of a lot of our definitions that we continue to carry over from the 20th century need to go, because a lot of these organizations, most notably the National Front, I mean, they have more in common with the left wing than anything else. They're not free trade, they're protectionist, they're big government. I think sometimes in the U.S. they use American terms simply because it's a way to be lazy and a way to take some unpopular people and some unpopular visuals in Europe and use them to smear domestic politics here for other purposes. But what's interesting about the movement for, I call them nationalist parties, it's a nationalist movement, is unlike the last time nationalism really got rolling in Europe, they weren't satisfied with their internal borders. These nationalist parties, except for the Hungarians that still have issues of parts of Romania that used to be Hungarian, most of these nationalist parties in Europe, they're internally focused. And a lot of their internal focus has to do with the fact that, not unlike what happened in the Weimar Republic, is the main line center-left, center-right political parties became more alike with each other than they became in tune with their own people. And the people of the countries do not feel like their democratic institutions, i.e. in their political parties, which in a parliamentary system are much more important than they are in the way our system is set up. And when good people who are desperate feel like they're being ignored, they will go someplace else. And where they're going is they're going to the National Front. They're going to Geert Wilders' party. They're going to other places. I think the one exception to whether you're talking about the National Front or you're looking at the Austrian People's Party, or was it Jobbik over in Hungary, one exception to these insurgent parties is UKIP, the UK Independence Party, and Nigel Farage. That's strictly economic and national interest. I don't think you could come anywhere close to putting them in line with the National Front that has a little bit of a smell of jackboot about it. But the UKIP, I think, is a perfect example of an insurgent party in a country whose main political parties refuse to address legitimate issues that well-meaning voters in those countries want addressed. UKIP specifically is not integrating with the rest of the European Union and immigration. The Conservative Party, when they came in, talked a good talk about limiting immigration from non-EU countries, but just never did what it said it did. And that is, from what I've seen, is probably a large part of why UKIP has gained so much power. Plus the fact with the euro crisis, they want somebody who's going to push back to stop Britain from becoming more and more integrated with what a lot of Brits see as a broken European experiment.
Well, speaking of interesting experiments, is France going to go through with the Mistral sale, LHA equivalent or LPD equivalent to Russia?
Yeah, full disclosure here, I love the French. I really do. I like Paris a lot. I'd rather, if you force me to live in a big city, I'd live in Paris over New York anytime, any place, anywhere. I'd live in Paris over London in a heartbeat. But there's some things about France that just drive me batty. And the French politicians, I don't know whether they represent the French people or not, but if they go through, in spite of all of what happens, selling those ships to the Russians, they've just prostituted themselves. We're just arguing over, what is the price? There's no reason why a nation who wants to help secure the best fruits of the Enlightenment would, after the first change in borders by the force of arms in Europe since World War II took place, would within a year turn over significant military capability. Those Mistrals are nice ships, very capable ships. We'll turn that over to the Russians because, let's be blunt, those aren't defensive weapons. Those are power projection weapons. I just think it'd be the height of irresponsibility of the French political and industrial elites to go through with that sale. I'd much rather have them sell them to Brazil or Chile. Eagle One, you still there? Eagle One, things have broken up a bit. Why don't you go ahead and dial back in? For some reason, he's on sound on us. but we'll wait for Eagle One to come back in. And, hey, we got another still another 15 minutes left on our kind of open, and nobody interesting has called in. If you want to call in, because we've been ignoring you in the chat room, this area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. You know, Lee, I've seen you in the chat room there as well. I know you want to come in and tell us how great the Joint High-Speed Vessel is. It's been hanging out in Northeast Florida. Okay, here's Eagle One. Let's bring him back. Eagle One, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm still here. I can't get anything to work. So it must be bad weather somewhere in the world.
Hey, let's shift over to one of our favorite micro topics here. I don't know. I've been kind of cackling like Almighty Tim from the Search for the Holy Grail over the last few months, as Big Navy has put out the. Tell us what type of frigate you would buy. What are the alternatives we can have here? After so many years of saying we don't need frigates, now they're looking something that they would like to see what the alternatives are besides LCS, which, and back me up here, because you were of a more cognizant age than I was when this took place, the much maligned and sometimes loved Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigate, that was something that came across pretty darn fast, too, from a developmental point of view, that Zumwalt pretty much said, okay, we'll take this compromise, we'll do this, we'll do that, now build them. Do you think we might have something radical like that take place, or do you think the financial conditions are such that, you know, even though the mid-70s was not the best financial situation in the world either, that we might actually see a little more capable ship come down the way besides LCS with this look at alternatives?
Yeah, there was an interesting news note that Sam LeGroin, whatever his name is, at Naval Institute News put out about they were going to reduce with some of the DDGs, they were going to reduce the amount of money they were going to spend on upgrading some of those and free up a bunch of money. So not all, you know, they would still be some of them would still be limited ballistic missile defense capable, but others would get the new improved radar and some other equipment, and you know, so they're going to save several hundred million dollars. And I started thinking, well, why would you do that unless you had an idea that you wanted to do spend some money on something other than these LCS things? But you know, in order to do that, they have to kill LCS somehow. They can't, and they've committed to 32. There must be some magic number that will make the politicians happy, but they better get on it in a hurry, because it takes, as we know, years to build ships. And there are enough. I mean, if it were me, I'm not a big fan of Oliver Hazard Perry because for a variety of reasons, but they're better than the LCS in a lot of ways because you know they're just like we upgunned the old Gearing class and Fletcher class destroyers, and they became much better ships. You know, there are ways to improve existing hulls that are already proven, and to the extent you can, put on different, better weapon systems without having to reinvent the wheel with the LCS. And you know, we could always go with our good buddy, I think it was Lee, who was always in favor of these joint. High-speed vessels, you know, that is a good hull that works. It's not a warfighter hull for a variety of reasons, but maybe something along those lines could be set up, and we could, you know, that was the original theory behind the LCS before we went crazy with some of the ideas we're going to have all these fancy component parts which we'll be able to load them up with.
Well, you know, Lee just made a comment over in the chat room. He was just on Spearhead last Wednesday, and she got underway for the Southern Partnership Station with 512 tons of cargo, 220 persons, in addition to 30 crew. It's scheduled to do both UAV and, you know, aerostat ops later. And it kind of goes into what you're talking about. They're not upgrading all of the Oliver Hazard Perrys. You don't need a fleet of, dare I say, Ferraris. When you get, it's okay to have some Fords up there. I, Arva said, you know what? I can convert a Lexus into a tractor, and I can put my cotton in a Lexus if I want to spend the money to modify it, and it'll do it just fine with enough angle iron and welding. But is that really the best use of a Lexus? Are you better off for keeping the Lexus to go to church on Sunday and then go buy you a good Kubota to go do everything else you want to do?
Our Turkish correspondent notes that the Royal Australian Navy and the Turkish Navy have invested a lot of money in their Fig 7s, and they've got some really nice ships.
They do.
It wouldn't be a bad idea to learn something from our allies every now and then.
Because they have a little bit of a different economic stress model, and, you know, and there are some issues with the Oliver Hazard Perry class, and you know, I'm not advocating rebuilding them or anything like that, but I think it really was a huge lost opportunity, and it's one of the things that Australia, their upgrade had some problems, but a lot of the problems and the costs there just had to do with economies of scale. That you're going to upgrade and instead of small single-digit ships, you said, you know what, that's an interesting program. We can fix this and that. We're going to do it at 25 ships. Your economies of scale shrink kind of significantly. I just hope that whatever we come up with our sub-9,000-ton surface ship, it's not a jacked-up LCS. That's the Lexus plow in the field. Then you have that huge plant that's designed to go real fast and now can't go real fast because it's got all this extra weight on it. And your semi-planing monohull is just pushing water around. We just need to suck it up. Barn design, I don't know. I think our folks at Cox and Gibbs have a couple of options. But, you know, the nation that built the fleet of World War II and during the economic problems of the 20s and 30s did some great developments. I'm sure with the right leadership and reorganization, we could produce something just fine. I got confidence in it.
Yeah.
One thing I don't have confidence in, though, is I don't, and I know this is unpopular for some of our readers, but I don't have confidence that our present Secretary of the Navy is the person to make it happen.
Well, the problem with the LCS was they decided it needed to go really, really fast. And, I appreciate the need for speed, but that gives you difficulties in ship design that are limiting factors in other areas. And I don't think we've done a good job sorting that out yet. So I think what they need mainly is like the general board would do, lay out the characteristics you want carefully and use. You know, if we're going to have small expendable ships, then they don't need to be the size of the LCS. They need to be small expendable boats, kind of like those ambassador-class missile boats we're sending over to Egypt, and then have a different class of ship for your frigates, which could be the same speed as LCS or whatever.
Yep, and I think whatever we go to, and from what I've read, this is the direction they're going in. Somebody needs to lock the good idea fairy away in a closet somewhere and triple lock it. It needs to be mature technology, established technology, et cetera, et cetera. None of these, so-and-so has promised that this will be ready for IOC within 2 years, and the first hull is going to come in 3 years. So why don't we just plan everything around what the good idea fairy says we should really have on this ship? Lucy, meet Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown, Lucy, here's a football. We don't need to take that chance again because we don't need to be having this discussion about whatever replaces it. So I think we're actually going in that direction, and there's plenty of good proven technology right now that's mature and floating around in our fleet and the fleets of other navies. We can produce a very capable and usable platform that gives the combatant commanders the ability to do what they need to do.
Yeah. There was a really good article, I can't remember where I saw it, but about how the F-35, and we learned to use the F-35 properly, and we've talked about it on this show several times, that instead of just being a 10 or 11 or 12 carrier We have a substantial craft at sea, on different amphibious, currently amphibious ship type platforms that can carry the F-35.
Yeah, I think some smart people will find a way to inventively do that. But, you know, there is something, economy is scale-wise with a large deck carrier, though, that when you get too much smaller, you're kind of limited. But they are good for limited ops. I'm not as big of a fan as others of completely getting rid of the big deck. I would be much more interested in the fact that we go back to having some big deck carriers that have some reach to them, that we have the ability to go back to long-range strike that our decks full of light fighters really can't do anymore. But I don't see anything in the pipeline that's really going to enable that, so we're just going to have to live with bringing our carriers a little closer to where the danger is, especially with a quasi-island nation like we are. If you want to project power overseas, unless you have really good basing agreements nearby, you know, the carrier is really going to be the only way to do it, because our forces are so addicted to air cover in one way or another. The F-35, I think we might actually see the F-18 have a little longer life than we think, if or when that finally reaches the fleet. I hope the smart people that are working on the Charlie variant make it work the way it wants to. I know I've been violating my own rule about wishing, hoping with the F-35, but that pretty much is my default option with the F-35 in spite of a lot of the issues that have come up about it. I'm wishing and hoping that it all works out, because if the F-35 turns out to be a lemon, we're in a heap of trouble. It's not like it was back when you were a Lieutenant JG, where you looked out on a carrier deck and you had F-4s, A-7s, A-6s, A-4s, another carrier over there instead of A-4s had A-1s. You had a pretty nice toolbox. So if scenario X came around, you probably had something that worked a lot better. And nowadays, we don't have that diverse toolbox to be able to respond to the unexpected. We have a very limited gene pool of tools that we can use out there, which is, I guess, is good from an economist's point of view, but from a warfighting point of view, I think that has a lot of assumptions and risks that go into it that really didn't exist before. Oh, and I forgot to mention, we used to have, what else were on those flight decks? We had KA-3s, EA-3s, S-3s, E-2s, all sorts of good diverse stuff on the deck. Don't have that anymore. Eagle One, I think we lost you again.
No.
Going once. Going twice. Oh, there you go. Thought I shocked you with my brilliant insight that made you speechless.
That's true. Hey, we're coming near the end of the show. What have you got coming up in your future? You going to make any book signings?
I don't think I'm going to be going anywhere for a few months. My summer and probably early fall is shot for a variety of ways. But I'll find out more this week. For the listeners here who read my home blog and my other things, if my writing seems a little light and limited over the next few months, it's not because I've lost interest. It's just that I'm physically not able to do it. My goal for this summer is to get healthy as soon as I can.
That's a good goal.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate everybody who joined us live there in the chat room, even though you all had a little bit of stage fright, didn't call in, but we like to have our little talk fest. As many of y'all, some of y'all know, before and after the show, Eagle One and I pontificate quite a bit. And sometimes we go, wow, we should have brought that up during the show. So this is what our little free-for-alls are for.
Yep. Thanks, folks, for dropping by. And we'll see you next week.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. And as always, if you have some good ideas for the show that you really would like us to do, pop us an email. Until then, have a great Navy Day.
Hello!